Case number 19-5934, United States of America versus Jeffrey Stokes. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Kozak for the appellant.
Good morning or good afternoon. Chris Kozak, Blue Shadley for Mr. Stokes. As I previously mentioned to Mr. Gifford, I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you, Judge Kethledge. May it please the court. This is a case basically boiled down to a credibility contest, whether or not the jury believed Mr. Robinson, who was the chief witness for the government and his co-conspirators, was crucial to the outcome here. The DEA agent who was basically running the lead on the case conceded that without Robinson's testimony, there was nothing. He never witnessed Mr. Stokes do anything incriminating. He wasn't aware of any objective evidence showing that he had done anything incriminating. And so the jury's willingness to believe him as a conspirator with a significant incentive to not tell the truth was sort of pivotal to this case. And the court has recognized in a lot of different contexts that when that's true, trial errors, even ones that seem insignificant, can have a profound impact on the outcome. For example, in the Mackey case, the court said that when it comes down to witness credibility, a single unchecked comment can tilt the scales in favor of conviction. And here you have the first mention of Mr. Stokes by Mr. Robinson was that 10 years ago or so, he had dealt drugs together with this guy, and that not only was it with Mr. Stokes, but it was with other people who were involved in the current conspiracy.
Mr. Kozak, before we get in the weeds about, you know, what was said, I mean, let's just back up for a second. And I mean, this case is different. I mean, let's talk about the way this actually comes in, because it seems quite different from cases like Jenkins that you cite in your brief, or Asher. Where the district court makes a decision to admit 404B testimony. In this case, the first mention seems totally unsolicited. The second mention is sort of maybe obliquely solicited, but these references to prior drug dealing, et cetera, come in sort of, you know, unplanned, and the district court never makes the decision to admit it. As a record matter, would you agree with that characterization?
Yes, in the sense that Judge Varlin never made an actual decision that the objection sustained or overruled. That's correct.
Right. And so what, in your view, is the district court's error exactly?
So the error under Olano is the violation of legal rule, which is the 404 prohibition on other acts evidence except in certain circumstances. But that's the error, is that the evidence came in, it went to the jury, went into evidence when it shouldn't have.
Well, what do you think? Okay, so the district court's sitting there, somebody asks a sort of a benign question, and all of a sudden the guy mentions that, you know, they used to deal drugs together. What, in your view, should the district court do at that point? Declare a mistrial? I mean,
no,
what did Judge Varlin do wrong?
I don't know that Judge Varlin did anything wrong, but that's not, I think that gets away from the question of what the error is, which is that the evidence came in. What should have happened, in my mind, is that defense counsel should have objected and asked that it be stricken and the jury instructed disregard it, but he didn't. And so it went in. And so the question, okay. I think.
Okay, so you think that, I mean, so the omission on defense counsel's part was objecting, hey, Your Honor, they shouldn't have just said my guy dealt drugs. And then you think what the district court should have done was give a curative instruction?
Yeah, and you should have sustained the objection. And I think I made this point, but if there had been an objection, I think it would have been, there really should have been no choice but to sustain the objection and direct the jury to disregard it
Okay, but I mean, we have this case Copeland. I mean, and it's just sort of a common sense proposition where in a similar circumstance, we said that it was not plain error for the district court not to have given a curative instruction because it would only draw more attention to the statement that should not have come in, which seems pretty common sense. And maybe that's why the defense counsel doesn't object. You're just going to highlight it for the jury.
Or at least it should be up to defense counsel rather than the judge who was sponsored to doing it.
Well, I think Copeland is distinguishable in the sense that it was a lot more, the comment was more benign, and it wasn't in any way related to the current charge. It was just a comment about, well, he had just got out of jail or something like that. And in that context, I don't, these are all very, very fact-specific cases. And in that context, I think it's probably correct to just sort of let it go. But here it was specific in all of the sort of all the wrong ways. I'm sorry, Judge White.
I coughed.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
But going back to your question, I think you said it should be up to defense counsel. And to some extent, I agree that it is up to defense counsel, and he should have objected, but he didn't. And that's sort of why we're here right now.
Well, and so, I mean, just to understand your argument, it would seem like it's plain error review. You agree with that, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so the question is whether it's obvious that the district court should have given a curative, sua sponte, should have given a curative instruction, notwithstanding defense counsel's decision not to object, which may well have been a strategic decision. I mean, that's kind of what you're asking us to do, isn't it?
Sort of, not quite. I think it's important to maintain the distinction between what was strategic and the error, because I think the discussion of strategic motives, and this comes out of some of the cases that Mr. Samuelson cites, those are in the habeas context where you have an ineffective assistance claim, where the argument is that defense counsel is there's no reasonable strategy for it. In that sense, the reason for not objecting is very relevant. Here, though, I don't think that what the judge did or didn't do is not the question about, it's not really relevant to what the error is. And I think the Rosales case makes that point pretty clearly that.
This seems a lot like the U.S. v. Henderson case, where you had some prior bad act evidence come in sort of in a long monologue, which is really exactly the way this came in during the first question to Robinson, the first time. So it's just long monologue, and he kind of has an incidental remark. And in that case, writing for the majority, Judge McKeague said, the district court can hardly be deemed to have had a sua sponte duty to specially call the jury's attention to these other bad acts. I mean, it's just, I'm hard pressed to see how this sort of reasoning doesn't apply here.
Yeah, and so two points I would make in response to that, Judge Kethledge. And the first is that I think Henderson is actually very different from this case. So in Henderson, you had this person who's charged with murdering a witness who testified against him, I don't know, 10, 15 years earlier in a bank robbery case. And they tried to introduce evidence of a conversation he had in which there were statements that he was armed and that he said something about admitting to killing the witness. And his argument was aimed at the admission about the murder, but that Judge McKee correctly found that was intrinsic evidence. The real extrinsic evidence problem was the question about the firearms. And I think he correctly said it was preposterous that the jury would attach any significance to this statement about being armed in the much larger context of you've been accused of, and in fact, this person testified that you admitted to committing a retaliatory murder. So this is different in the sense that you have a prior act that is both similar in severity to the charged crime, that's the point. Sorry, it's not 2 points. So that would be one argument that it's not the same thing. And again, I'd say these cases are all very, very fact specific. And when you have that sort of blip, that isn't as serious as what's going on in the trial court, there's a different way to approach it. And the second thing is, I think Henderson was decided before the Supreme Court clarified that under Rule 52B, you don't look at what the trial court did or didn't do. You ask what the error is. And the judge's reaction to it isn't the error that's being assigned.
What case are you referring to? What Supreme Court case?
Oh, this is the Rosales case where they talk about, and it is in the context of the fourth Olano prong, mm-hmm. but it translates here too, where they said don't focus on what the Fifth Circuit did in that case, was they focused on what the district judge should have done, whether it was worthy of stern disapproval, and the court said that modifies what the Olano test is. But we're looking at whether there was a legal rule that was violated, right, not whether the judge reacted appropriately to it.
So do you think that the mode of analysis that our court used in Henderson is superseded by this approach? It's not about whether the district court should have done something. It's just some bad evidence came in and therefore we reverse.
I mean, it's not directly, so it didn't address this direct point, but I think it's called into question by the way the
We have to call balls or strikes. I mean, if Henderson, do we apply Henderson, or is the question here only whether evidence came in violation of 404B and whether that was prejudicial, and then the blamelessness of the district court notwithstanding, we would reverse. I mean, which type of analysis should we apply?
I see my time is out. Would you like me to answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So in terms of calling balls or strikes, Judge Keth, I would say it is a strike. I think if the analysis in the Rosales case is incompatible with the way that Henderson dealt and Copeland dealt with it, that's in short, that'd be what I.
Okay, very good. Go ahead.
Does the ruling of the district court sort of come into the plain error analysis?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand the question there.
Okay, so we are looking at this under plain error analysis, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so is there any role for looking at what the district judge should have done in that analysis? Or are you saying that it's not a plain error analysis? It's just, if it's bad enough, it doesn't matter. But isn't that just the second prong of the plain error analysis? Where there's prejudice and it just wasn't a fair trial because of the error?
So the prejudice question is separate. It's whether or not it affected substantial rights. But I would, in answering the question, I would draw you back to the language of Rule 52, which says a plain error that affects substantial rights may be considered even though it was not brought to the district court's attention. So I guess textually it makes no sense to me to say, well, you didn't bring the district judge's failure to give a limiting instruction to its attention. It seems sort of awkward to read the rule like that. What makes more sense, and what I think is what the court was getting at in the Rosales case, was that the error is the error. And the prejudice question is what its impact on the trial. But since you don't really bring the district court's failure to do something in response to a problem to its attention, that's what you're supposed to make the objection to the error. So I would say that the reaction maybe has some relevancy to the question, but it shouldn't be the primary focus. The focus should be on the error and what came into evidence. And unless there are other questions, I would like to reserve whatever remains of my time.
Okay, you're going to have your 3 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Brian Samuelson and I represent the United States. The district court did not commit error, let alone plain error, in the way it handled Robinson's testimony or in the way it instructed the jury. I'd like to start with the evidentiary issue. There was no error here because the court did exactly what it should have done if the defense counsel had objected at the time. If defense counsel had objected to this testimony when it was stated, he would have been entitled to a limiting instruction. And that is precisely what the court does. In the brief, I refer to two limiting instructions. While preparing for oral argument, I realized that there are, in fact, three. The first occurs immediately after Robinson's direct examination testimonies. Before he even gets to cross-examination, the court says, remember that the defendant is only on trial for the crimes charged in the indictment. That occurs on page 10393. And then that instruction is repeated twice at the close of evidence. He says, remember, he's only on trial for the crimes charged. To the extent that the defendant would have liked a more specific instruction, he may have been entitled to that instruction had he objected at trial. But the court is under no duty to sua sponte draw attention to evidence that may be prejudicial. That is what the Copeland case says, a case that is very much on fours with this case. And in fact, not only is there no duty to draw attention to this kind of evidence, it may in fact have been harmful to the defense strategy and done much more harm than good as a limiting instruction. We know that the defense attorney in this case was quite vigorous in objecting to this kind of testimony when it was brought up pre-trial. I mean, he debates the government sought permission before trial on a number of pieces of evidence, and the attorney was not hesitant to object to those on 404B grounds. The fact that he didn't do that midstream in trial, I think, suggests that this may have been a strategic decision, and the court was certainly under no obligation to undermine that strategy by striking the testimony immediately. So it did the next best thing, which is to repeatedly give these limiting instructions that don't reference the evidence specifically, but say he's not on trial for prior bad acts. So because the court gave instructions, and it gave the same instructions that would have properly been given if the defendant had objected, there is in fact no error.
It is unfortunate that the government asked this second question of Mr. Robinson at trial when he said, you were trying to get him broke in, being Mr. Stokes. They're asking is Robinson getting Stokes broken into this dealing program? And it says, did you teach him how to do it? I mean, it's really inviting. It's a yes or no answer. And if the answer is no, then you get exactly what we got, which is no, he already knew how to deal drugs. I mean, whatever happens here, it's pretty unfortunate that the government, it's regrettable that the government asked that question.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would make two points. One, I think the second piece of testimony that is objected to that you were talking about, you know, the witness does not say where Mr. Stokes learned to do this. He doesn't say, you know, I didn't have to teach him to do it because he already learned it because we were selling drugs back then.
It's still pretty bad to say, no, he already knew how to sell drugs. He was already a drug dealer is basically what the jury's hearing at this point.
Well, in fact, just a couple paragraphs before in that testimony, Robinson had testified that Stokes was, in fact, a frequent visitor to the spot, that before he joined the conspiracy, he was a customer at the spot, and that he frequently, you know, every other week or so, he would buy cocaine at the spot, and that's sort of how he became involved in the conspiracy. So I don't think it invites the jury to speculate about history outside the conspiracy.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is the government should be careful, should not ask these sorts of questions. That's just the message I'm asking you to pass on. Because we wouldn't be here with this, at least, without a question that basically invited this.
Yes, Your Honor, and I appreciate that, and I will make sure that that message is relayed.
Thanks.
Pivoting a little bit, I think if there was an error in this case, if the court should have done something else other than the limiting instructions it gave, there is no prejudice to the defendant in this case. I think the comments we have are brief and they are vague, and most importantly, they didn't do anything to enhance Robinson's credibility with the jury. By the time these comments were made, the jury was well aware that the defendant's main strategy in this case was to cast doubt on Robinson's credibility. His defense was that Robinson was lying. And if the jury believed that Robinson was lying, then they would not believe these statements either. And if, as apparently they did, the jury believed that Robinson was credible, they would convict Stokes based on the detailed testimony about his participation in the conspiracy. So this is not a case like Asher or like Jenkins, where there was independent corroboration that the defendant was in fact had a bad character or had done something bad in the past. So I don't think there was error, and I don't think there was prejudice in any case. Turning to the jury instructions issue, the requested reporting instruction. Just setting aside the merits of that instruction, it cannot have been plain error not to give that instruction. A lack of binding precedent precludes a finding of plain error. That's the Al-Maliki case. And here there are no cases where an instruction like this was even given, let alone required. And so the Supreme Court, if it had meant to give such an instruction in Peña-Rodriguez, I think it would have said that. It does not say that. In fact, it suggests the opposite. It says that it's not changing the mechanics for acquiring information from the jury. It notes that rules often put limits on who may talk to the jury about deliberations. And the Supreme Court further notes that under those rules, jurors are under no obligation to discuss the case. So It simply was not plain error in any event for the court not to give this instruction where it was never requested, and there's no authority that it should be required or is ever given.
Very well.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for the government?
No.
Well, thank you, Mr. Samuelson. We'll hear rebuttal. There you go.
Okay, I was waiting to be sure the timer was working.
A couple
quick points. One, talking about motive for why defense counsel did or didn't object, why he may or may not have done that. I think something key to take into consideration is that he may have been completely blindsided by this. The government disclosed a notice of intent to use other 404B evidence, and I presume that was because he asked for disclosure of that evidence. There's a discovery order requiring it. So I can't imagine he was on the lookout for this sort of stuff, because he never had noticed that this was going to be, that Mr. Robinson even might say this. So I think that's important to consider when talking about if we're going to inject why, what was the speculation about why he didn't object to it. Was it strategic? Was it not to dismiss it? I think it's important to take that into consideration. I think it's also important to consider the context of both of these statements. The statements that Mr. Robinson made that were error here were made at the very beginning of his testimony, before he really got into the weeds of his claims that Stokes was part of the conspiracy. So it really had a strong potential to color the jury's perception of the case. It's the first thing they hear. They hear that he dealt drugs with Robinson a decade ago and that he already knew how to do it. So the jury goes into all of this evidence of Robinson claiming that he's involved with that stuck in their mind. And the lesson from Asher and Jenkins is that that stuff is just really hard for a jury to disregard. And the general instruction that the judge gave, which is all good, both Jenkins and Asher recognize that that sometimes is just not enough. And that the addressing this specifically is key to keeping the jury from relying on the sort of propensity evidence that the rule forbids. So I think talking about enhancing his credibility, it does to some extent, it's a human instinct to think that if you did it before, you probably did it again. And it makes it look more like this is just an instance of you got all your friends back together again. But I think the real prejudice here is that it colored the jury's perception of the whole case before they even heard any sort of directly incriminating statements about Mr. Stokes.
The phone calls are pretty bad for your client. Would you agree with that?
No, actually, I wouldn't, because Agent Blanton even conceded on cross-examination that nothing in the calls was, I think in his words, quote, absolutely not incriminating by themselves. So they're bad in light of what Robinson said they meant, but they weren't bad in and of themselves, and I would go with the DEA's assessment of that.
I don't think the jury is going to use their, you know, just their sort of common sense to see through references to the fudge round box and, you know, I made a juke before I came here, my little junkie, you know, bought a certain juke or whatever. I mean,
sorry, I kind of lost you there at the end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, some of these calls, like referring to my little junkie and so on, I mean, they just seem arguably to have been transparently about drugs. I'm giving you a chance to argue that they're not.
Well, and I think I return to the point that Blanton said he needed Robinson's testimony to connect those. And so I think if the jury is going in that direction, you look at all the evidence, and I think that in light of that testimony from the government's witness, they'd have to take that into account.
Okay.
So I think that's the trouble here. And the other thing is that all came after, again, both of the statements that are problematic here. And so it just further colors the way that they're looking at it.
Okay, so very good.
That would be my response to that.
Okay, I appreciate it. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Kozak, I know that you've been appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act. And on behalf of the panel, I want to thank you for your very spirited and able advocacy on behalf of your client. It's a service to what we do here, and we thank you. Thank the government for its arguments as well. The case will be submitted.